This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9-1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Welcome back to Ruined. My name is Hallie.
And my name is Allison.
And this is the podcast where we ruin a horror movie for you every single week until the sun burns out and we all die.
So like 6 to 9 years from now, oh, probably?
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, God. We're all
I'm hoping for 30, but that's really, the more you read, the less 30. Certain I am of that. Yeah, who do I think I am? We're going to get 30 good years left out of this earth.
Good. I'm like 30 years at all sounds bold. And we do ruin a movie every week, except for this week, where we have an extra bonus episode for America's birthday. Probably the ultimate horrific holiday, scarier than Halloween, based in much more terror and trauma than any other day could be, probably. I'm like, let's dig into stuff that we're not qualified to talk about.
I'm like, well, Thanksgiving, you know, Memorial Day, there's a lot of terrifying.
Is just as bad.
Yeah, we wanted to bring you a little extra treat while you're out running around on your lawn, on your slip and slides.
Play this at a barbecue. See how that goes.
Yeah, just instead of music at a barbecue, it's just our podcast. God, that's a fun idea.
Just listening to like two ladies talk about a movie that you have or haven't seen.
Now, we went through a very complicated rubric to decide what to do for 4th of July. And that rubric was, horror movies take place on 4th of July? And then I Googled it. Okay, so you've got to look at all the painstaking work we put into this podcast.
Yes, yes. The legwork is there. And the movie we are doing was recommended by Christy to us on Instagram. So thank you, Christy, for recommending this brilliant, important film, I Know What You Did Last Summer.
It is from 1997, our heyday, me and Allison's heyday, I would say, when we were in, I believe, middle school.
Yeah, and seventh to eighth grade. This is a formative film viewing years.
Yes, this is, I think, every generation, the movies you see during puberty, which I guess is hard because a different group of people are going through puberty every year, so it's every movie is formative, I suppose.
But there are defining kind of like eras of
absolutely
film. And I feel like especially horror, and this one to me, and like, again, maybe because it's our heyday. Also, our heyday being when we were like 13. Are like that these movies, like it was this movie, Urban Legend, Disturbing Behavior. Like there was just like, there were like 20 young actors that were just cycling through like 15 of the same movie, it seemed like.
Absolutely. And four of them star in this film. Those actors are, of course, Jennifer Love Hewitt, woo, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Ryan Phillippe, I want to say.
Phillippe.
And of course, the one and only Freddie Prinze Jr. I mean, these are, in my mind, still the biggest stars we have.
Yes. Yes. To me, those are still four famous people and not afterthoughts at a Hollywood party, which is what I think that they might
be. Oh, my God.
To this generation.
I cannot believe that I have not thought of this until this moment. Literally, this past weekend, I went to the Brentwood Country Mart, if you guys live in Los Angeles, to get some, I was getting shoes repaired. My wild and crazy weekends. And while I was getting coffee with Dave, I turn around and who do I see? And yes, he was masked, but I could tell it was him. And also everyone else was staring at him because it was obvious it was him. Allison, I was in the same coffee shop with Freddie Prinze Jr. not even a fortnight ago.
I thought that you were going to say he was also getting shoes repaired.
But he might have been. Maybe that's why he was there too.
We don't know that he wasn't.
Absolutely not. But I did see him waiting for coffee. So I know he drinks coffee. So that's like a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon away from everybody.
Yeah, you're basically in this movie. What coffee? Did you catch what coffee he ordered?
Absolutely not. I was agog. I was starstruck, if you will, just by the top of his face because he was masked because he's not completely insane.
Because he's great. Yeah.
But we were excited to bring this to you. Also, an interesting point about this movie, it is written by Kevin Williamson, who is the same screenwriter who wrote Scream. So if he actually wrote this before Scream, couldn't sell it, and then Scream, of course, ended up being successful, and then he was able to do whatever the hell he wants with the biggest stars in Hollywood and have them all 25. Be brutally murdered. And it is based on a 1973 novel of the same name by Lois Duncan, and she actually hates the movie because they completely changed her book. And she can't stand it.
Oh, I'm interested to know what changed.
Well, apparently a lot. I guess it is more of a, it's like a mystery novel. And she felt like the movie is a slasher movie, which it absolutely is. Yeah. So she's like, you kind of, instead of having it be a mystery, it's just about hotties being slaughtered. And that is a fair critique,
I think.
She's
not wrong.
Absolutely not. Allison, I had you watch the I Know What You Did Last Summer trailer. What are your feelings about the movie based on the trailer?
I mean, I even said to you, I can't tell if I've seen this movie or not because the marketing and the, like, noise around this movie when I was 13 years old could not have been more deafening. Like, it was, I feel like, it was constantly advertised on TV. I was seeing the poster and the trailer, like, always, like, before other movies. And, like, I just, like, they were, like, all four of them were, like, heavily part of, like, the MTV Movie Awards cinematic universe. So, like, they were kind of, like, they're, like, showing clips. They're doing parodies. They're, like, they're all presenters. They're all winning. So, like, I feel like watching this trailer, I was both transported back in time to being in middle school, which was horrific, and also was, like, this all feels very familiar, but I don't know one single thing about this movie.
Perfect. That's also how I feel about a lot of movies from that era, where I'm like, I'm pretty sure I saw it. I retain nothing. We also like to take a baseline scary about a film's premise. So, Allison, how scary do you find the premise of being the bad guy?
Ooh, very scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because guilt is terrible.
Absolutely.
I don't even like when, like, I've, like, made someone feel bad. I'm like, oh, no, this is awful.
Yeah.
So let alone murder or other maimings. I feel like it's terrible.
Yeah, I you know, I listen to a lot of true crime, and I am always sort of shocked by scenarios where I think that they probably, someone did get away with murder. Because I know that if I was even involved remotely in this kind of situation, the second anyone asked me one question about anything, I would be sobbing, hyperventilating. I don't have the constitution to cover up a murder.
Yeah, no, I would disintegrate under the slightest of pressure.
Right, yeah.
Like, it would just be completely, it'd be over. I'd be like, I'll tell you everything.
Exactly. And that's why we're recording this, so that when the cops hear it, they think, oh, well, they couldn't have done it. But then, of course.
Exactly. This is a red herring.
And then finally, based solely on Jennifer Love Hewitt's appearance on the MTV Music Awards in 1997, what do you think the twist will be in I Know What You Did Last Summer?
Guess the twist.
I mean, the trailer lets us think that at some point it could be one of them that's terrorizing everybody. But I feel like it's going to be like some out of left field third party.
Those are both two spectacular guesses.
Okay, great.
And speaking of spectacular, please enjoy the fireworks. At least in LA, I'm sure there will be pretty much 72 hours of fireworks going on.
Yes, same with New York.
It's a little ahead of the holiday, but kick back. Relax, open up a beer.
Keep flipping those burgers because you're at a barbecue listening to this.
Again, hello to everyone at your barbecue. We're sorry that we're being played now, but also we're about to tell you the plot of a movie. Yes, could you just watch it? But that's the whole point of our podcast.
Right, you're so not you going don't to. Have to.
Curl up with, I would say, 30 to 40 steamed crabs. This is a very crab-heavy film. Mm-hmm. Allison, I feel like you're. It reminded me of your upbringing.
I'm ready to talk about crabs. I hope that doesn't get pulled out of context.
Pop open a crab and go to town because we are about to ruin.
Pop open a crab. That's how we say it.
Pop open a crab. I wasn't raised in Maryland, but I'm pretty sure. Wait, are you from Maryland or Massachusetts?
Maryland.
Great. The crabs date, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, we're all crabs. It's all crabs there.
Please pop open a crab and enjoy as we ruin I Know What You Did Last Summer. We open on a man in fishing boots sitting on a rocky cliff overlooking a sheer drop off to the ocean. He holds in his hand a medallion. I don't know what the word for this is, but you like spin the medallion, and when it spins, it says, I love you. But then if you just have it resting, it looks like it's just the bottom or top half of the phrase. This is a very, I feel like in the 90s, necklaces had a lot going on. There were a lot of different options.
Remember those necklaces you could get at kiosks at the mall where they would write your name on a grain of rice and then like put it in glass?
Was I obsessed with them? Everyone I knew had one. I still don't know how they were able to do it.
It boggles my mind. Like that, and then also like all of the clay that was like made into it looked like a giant Swiss roll that they cut, and then each disc had a beautiful design that was made by rolling it up.
I guess they were like, oh, absolutely. I guess they were like throwback 70s type of things. Like, because there was a lot of clay. There was a lot of like glass beads.
The 90s were pretty tapped into the 70s. So I think I know what you mean, but let's make sure when this drops that we post it in Instagram.
I also want to say I was in youth group around this time with a kid named Shanez. And not to date ourselves, but we would shop a lot, you know, from Delia's or something. It would be like a lot of catalog or magazine shopping. Mm. And he came to youth group and he had a pentagram necklace. And I was like, that's the devil symbol. I thought it was cool. If anything, that's what he was doing. He's like, oh my God, I didn't know. I just thought it looked good. And I was like, what a beautiful like 12-year-old thing. It was like, oh no, I saw it like in a magazine. And now I have the symbol of the devil at youth group.
Yeah, a girl who was wearing, like, you know, a sweater vest with no shirt under it and carpenter jeans had this necklace on, and I thought it looked cool. Like,
and now the devil got the devil. That's how the devil gets inside your body.
That's how the devil gets you. It's Argyle sweater vests worn as shirts.
So we see our gentleman. He's obviously very sad. He is drinking, again, on a sheer cliff, like, leading to a drop-off. And as
this all now feels on him.
Yeah, and as he drinks, he's startled by a fireworks display. It is the 4th of July in beautiful Southport, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And we meet three of our four protagonists, Julie, who is, of course, Jennifer Love Hewitt, Ray, who is played by Freddie Prinze Jr., and Barry, Ryan Felipe. And they are watching from a balcony above the audience as Helen, played by Sarah Michelle Gellar, competes for the title of Croaker Queen, which is a beauty pageant they have every year. It says Croaker Queen. There's not a lot of frog imagery, so I'm not exactly sure what croakers referred to. But Helen comes out, and she just destroys the competition. Like, she is answering questions. Everyone loves her, and she walks away with the crown. And she sort of, tells Julie, you know, like, I'm going to go away. I'm going to be a professional actress. I'm going to be incredibly successful. And people don't understand how much of that has to do with how good your hair is. You know, it's all about the do. And
she's not wrong.
And Julie, who's sort of, because she's the brunette, sort of like more of the feminist, like, oh my gosh, I'm in sexist overload even being here, you know. But they're all have just graduated high school. They're sort of having their last summer. Helen and Julie are best friends. Julie is dating Ray and Helen is dating Barry. So it's sort of like, oh my God, like we're doing it. Like we're finally going to go away live our lives. Ray is Freddie Prinze Jr.
Freddie Prinze Jr.
So he's dating Julie, who is Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Okay.
It's blonde. It's two brunettes together, okay. Which is the way it should be. Okay. Yes. Don't you dare put a redhead in it because then I have to redo the whole configuration. Yeah,
it ruins the entire configuration.
Helen has
so that's easy to remember.
Yes. So Helen has an older sister, Elsa, who she kind of blows off. She's like the frumpier older sister. Meanwhile, she's like just a blonde woman they put glasses on who's like a supermodel.
Stunning. Yeah.
And, and Julie gets asked out by this guy, Max, who is played by Johnny Galecki from Big Bang Theory. And Max is clearly in love with Julie, but Julie's like, well, I kind of already got a boyfriend. And like, you're just some guy I know from school. And Barry, who is already wasted, ends up getting into a fight with Max, shoving him. And Ray has to break it up. So Ray's sort of the level-headed, like, nice boyfriend, you know, as far as we know.
Sure.
So they decide we're going to peel off from the festivities. You know, there's a big crowd on the boardwalk. And, like, again, everyone's cracking open a crab, which that's how people say it. And they drive down a very precarious, winding coastal highway to Dawson's Beach.
Great.
And they build a fire on the beach, and they're telling the story of the hook for a hand. Are you familiar with that urban legend, Allison?
So, like, I remember it being, like, it was on the car. It was like something, it had to do with a car. Like it's because it's like somebody like stops and like goes back or something like that. I don't really remember the specifics of it, but I know a car is involved.
Absolutely. Now you're telling it like Ray tells us. So Ray's sort of insisting that's the way they get back to the house, and it turns out there's a hook on the door handle. And everyone else is like, no, the guy gets out to look, and then they hear a dripping on the hood, and they're like, no, it's not a dripping, it's a scratching, because he's being hung from the tree and he's decapitated. So they're all arguing about, like, the hook for a hand legend.
Sure.
Which is kind of a fun, you know, setting up what our film is going to be. And Julie's like, that story is just to warn young girls about the dangers of having premarital sex. The hook is a phallic symbol, you know.
Oh, God.
And Ray says, you know, a lot of urban legends are based on real life incidents, you know, or are they? I don't think that one is, but I could be wrong.
No, I don't. I mean, whatever. Lots of people have been murdered over the years, so.
That's true. That's a good point. Every urban legend is based on someone being murdered, and that happens all the time.
Yeah.
So we find out that Helen and Ray are headed to, they're both headed to New York, and Julie's going to Boston for college, and Barry, he's going to college somewhere, but Barry's like this spoiled, drunk, narcissistic, rich boy, which is why Ryan Felipe is perfect casting.
He's like, he's the prototypical version of that in every movie of this era. I mean, Cruel Intentions, come on, one of the best.
Right. And it's sort of like implied, like whatever he ends up doing, he's going to be fine, but he's also going to be a complete asshole.
Yes.
So they're on the beach and the two couples sort of break off. Helen is telling, and Barry are wasted by the fire. And she's telling him, like, I'm going to be on Days of Our Lives and you're going to be a linebacker for the Pittsburgh Steelers. We're going to have three children and then you're going to go to rehab. But then after that, we're going to be happy together. And Ray and Julie sort of sneak away. And the implication is that Julie has not had sex before, so this is the first time they're having sex. And they sneak away, and it's like, you know, will our relationship survive this? I can't say, but in the moment, while we're near the hull of a decrepit, falling apart boat on this beach, let's do this. And Ray really thinks that their relationship is going to survive. He tells her, like, high school sweethearts have the higher likelihood of success than any other relationship. And then they pork on the beach, and it's beautiful. When they go to leave...
Is that grounded in any fact?
You know, I like to... I guess, you know, I don't know the science of it, but I suppose at least historically in our country when people were getting younger, the statistics would probably bear that out.
Yes.
Now I don't know.
No, I don't know if that's true now.
But if it's like the late 90s and it's like, okay, the generations before, you're sort of just getting married to people after high school. But then look how that turned out. I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like now divorces, you know, everyone's got to have one or two under their belt.
At least.
That's not a criticism at all.
No, just because fact.
So they go to leave and Barry is so wasted. They manage to get the keys away from him. And he's like, he's in the back of the car as they drive again on this precarious road. I looked up and they shot it in California because, like, I'm not familiar with North Carolina, but they do. I don't think they have those sheer drop off cliffs.
North Carolina is all flat.
Yeah.
Like, at the beach. Like the coastal part of North Carolina is like below sea level.
I think it's like when we did Jeepers Creepers and they were shooting it in Florida and they kept having to make the film look darker because Florida was just so sunny and nice looking.
Yeah.
Similarly, they couldn't shoot North Carolina because you just wouldn't believe this kind of thing would happen there.
Yeah, there's no cliffs in North Carolina.
So Ray's driving the car, but, you know, Barry is screaming. He's like changing. He's like splashing liquor all over the car. And he's like, I don't let anyone drive my car, you know. And he jumps out of the sunroof and he's screaming and he's like flailing around and he drops his liquor bottle into Ray's lap. And of course, you know, Ray looks down and in that moment, something or someone steps in front of the car and they just slam right into it. And they screech to a halt and they're like, it was just a dog. It was just a deer. And then Julie picks up a bloody boot. It's like, oh, a dog doesn't wear boots. A deer wouldn't wear boots. It's a person.
That's a person.
They find a person laying in the highway. It's the body of a man. It appears to be the man we just saw on the cliffs. And his face is covered in blood. We can't really make him out. And they have Ray check to see if he has a pulse, and things do not look good. So Julie's like, we have to call the police, you know, whatever. And Barry says, we're not calling anyone. Oh. And Barry sort of lays out. He's like, I'm drunk. This is my car. Even though Ray was driving, they're not going to believe him. There's booze everywhere.
Yeah, they're teenagers.
I dropped booze. Also, we're dumb as hell, you know.
Right. Yeah, we're idiots.
All of our lives are going to be ruined. And Julie has a scholarship to go away to college. And, you know, all of them are sort of like, well, what should we do about it? Julie's the only one who consistently is like, we can't just hide this. We can't just cover this up, you know? And Ray eventually turns to her and was like, I'm not like you guys. Like, Julie, you have like a family who take care of you, and Barry and Helen are rich. Like, I have nothing, you know, like I work on the docks. I've never met my dad. I don't have, if anyone's going to go down for this, it's not going to be Barry. It's going to be me, because I was driving also. Like, and
he's
so he's
correct.
Yeah. But also he is sort of saying like, so it's, we're not going to tell anyone that we murdered somebody inadvertently.
Yes. Oh yeah. No, it's terrible, but he's correct.
But I guess maybe that's maybe I'm making assumptions. Allison, if you were in this situation, would you call the cops?
Yes, absolutely.
And me too. I can't hide a body. I can't cover up a crime.
He's not correct to be like, this is how, like, but he's correct
he's,
that, like,
yes, he's
it
correct.
Would,
his life will
it
be
would
ruined.
Absolutely fall to him, and the others would have much lighter yes. consequences.
Just then, another car drives towards them down the road, and they're able to sort of like roll the body behind the guardrail.
Oh my God.
As the driver stops to help them, and it's Max, Johnny Galecki from earlier. And he's just, like, already so antagonistic. And he sees Barry's car. He's like, Daddy's going to be mad. So he sees the car is wrecked, but he assumes Barry's just drunk and, like, they slammed into the guardrail or something. He does not see the body. But Ray comes over to the car, and Max tells him, you could wipe that my shit don't stink smile off your face. You almost got that rich boy act figured out. So we're to understand Max and Ray sort of grew up, you know, they're, like, the wrong side of the tracks.
Yes.
Dock workers' sons.
Got it.
And Ray's the only one who's kind of trying to, like, date above his, you know, his class.
Class.
And Max, like, I've got you pegged. Don't think I don't. Luckily, Julie says, hey, just keep it moving. And Max drives on, you know, not thinking too much of it.
Right.
So they take the body down to the docks to throw it in the water. And right before they do, Julie sees that there's a tattoo on his arm. And she stops and she's like, should we check his wallet to know who he is? Which is another interesting question. Helen's like, I do not want to know. You know, Barry says, let's just pretend he was a killer with a hook and we're actually helping the world. Let's pretend he was a bad person.
Way to go, insane. Barry. Way to rationalize yourself into covering up a murder that you committed.
And Ray, because he's not a completely bad person, Ray is finally like, no, you're right. This is a bad idea. We can't do this. And Helen says, fine, I'll do it my fucking self. And Helen reaches down to roll the body into the water. And the body sits up and grabs at her. The guy's not dead. But she shoves him in the water and he grabs the crown off of her head. So he is now holding her coveted croaker queen crown. So Barry screams, no, but in a very funny way where he's like exasperated. Like he's just like, God damn it. He jumps in the water and he has to like pull the crown out of the body's hand. And as soon as he does, the body's eyes open and looks at him. And he goes back to the surface. He does not tell him he saw the body's eyes open.
This guy.
Yeah.
this is not a good guy, in the words of Frank Costanza. It's like, I'm already now, like, I hope you are the first, like, victim of what's coming towards you.
Well, if you didn't think that already, Barry, as they get in the car, tells them, we never speak of this again, and we make a pact that we take this to our graves, and they all agree except for Julie, who's, like, uncertain. Barry grabs her by the throat and, like, slams her against the car, and is like,
we take this to our grave! Let me hear it!
Let it go, Barry!
You fucking say it.
Okay, Barry, we take this to the grave.
It'll be okay.
And Julie's so disgusted that Ray's just like, let this happen, that she gets in the car. And you find out we are now 1 year later. It is about to be 4th of July.
Wow, okay.
Julie is packing up. Her roommate, Deb, is helping her pack up. A roommate, Deb, who gets two lines, like you see her one other time in the movie, to go back to Southport, and Julie really does not want to go back. And Julie looks terrible. Like, she's gray. She's obviously been racked by guilt this whole year.
Yes. And I mean, I would be incapable of living my life.
Exactly. I would have to go to the police eventually. You know, I wouldn't be able to do it. And so she goes back down, and so this is the first time she's been back to Southport. And I guess we're to think, like, she stayed to take some classes, but then the summer session ends right before 4th of July. So she's getting there right in time. and she shows back up, and Julie's father's died, but her mother's really trying to connect with her. Like, you haven't called, like, you haven't visited. Like, are you on drugs? That's, like, the immediate, in every horror movie, it's like, are you on drugs? Like,
right.
Well, to be fair, that's the more realistic assumption
than, like, covering up a secret murder that my friends and I swore we'd never tell anyone about.
Exactly. And, you know, also it turns out Julie's grades are tanking, and she sort of has, like, a semester to get her grades up or she's going to lose her scholarship. So you can understand her mom being sort of up in her business. And yes. Her mom's like, a piece of mail came for you. Also, I got your report card. It's bullshit. And Julie's really distressed by this, but then she opens up the letter she receives, which has no stamp, no postage, no return address. And she opens it up, and Allison, what does this letter say?
I know what you did last summer.
Which brings me to my first question. What would you do?
What would you do?
I mean, this is such an easy one, which is I would immediately be like, fuck the pact, fuck these other people, my life is ruined, we killed somebody, I'm going to the police and confessing to, like, and telling them what happened.
It also implies it's like you can never tell, not that I like tell my mother everything or whatever, but I just right. gotta think I would have to talk to my parents face to face, having known I was complicit in a murder and not eventually tell them. I don't think I'd be capable of it. I'd be running upstairs like, Mom, I have something to tell you.
Yeah, yeah. I would need to tell my mom.
Yeah.
And my dad. He's like the problem solver.
So the next day, Julie heads into town and she goes to the clothing store, which is kind of like a small time department store owned by Helen's parents. And we see like everyone in town's like putting up decorations, like the parade's going to be the next couple days.
Oh God.
And she finds Elsa, who is a huge bitch for no reason. And she says, oh, hey, can I get Helen's number in New York? Because I really need to talk to her about the fact that someone clearly knows we killed that guy. And Elsa says she doesn't have a number in New York. She works in women's perfume 10 feet to your right. And she looks over. Turns out Helen did go to New York. But again, she's so racked with guilt, she had to drop out and come back.
Yeah.
She wasn't able to do it. No. And they have this like very awkward reunion. And Julie shows Helen the note. And we see Elsa kind of eavesdropping from the dressing rooms and then sort of disappearing behind a door frame. Helen is dismayed, but not that shocked, where it's like, okay, well, we all knew this was going to happen. Like, something was going to blow, like, in our fucking faces.
Same.
So they decide to go to Barry's house. Of course, Julie doesn't know this, but finds out that Helen and Barry also broke up, just like how she and Ray broke up.
Oh, wow.
Like, yeah. they have not spoken, basically, since then. Like, their friendships and their relationships fell apart, understandably.
Yes. Understandably. This is too much stress, especially for, like, 18-year-old friendship.
Exactly.
Which I feel like is already kind of fraught.
Right. And it's like, as a friend, you just talk about the things you have in common. And if you're not allowed to talk about this, what's there to talk about?
This is the biggest thing you have in common with your friends. If you guys collectively cover up a manslaughter, and then eventually, I guess it is just kind of murder because they throw them in the river.
Yes.
Or the ocean. Like, that's the thing you would have, that's what you have in common.
Exactly.
It's not that you went to the same school. It's not that you guys all like the same band. It's that you murdered someone together.
So they go to Barry's house, and because he's an absolute prick and absolutely going to die during this film, he says, this is nothing. I know what you did last summer. What a crock of shit. And he's basically suggesting, how do we know this note is even about that guy we killed? You know, he says to Julie, you did a lot of things last summer. And Julie says, well, only one murder comes to mind. And they get into this big fight. He's like, this is bullshit. Again, his reaction is to fight. You can't fight the fact that you killed somebody, you know?
Right.
Not
that
in this
is always
way.
Going to win. Right.
He also had a fight later where he says, you both look like shit run over twice. Because Julie and Helen do look physically bad because obviously they have, you know,
actual guilt.
Yeah. Barry looks fucking awesome. He's in the gym every day. Like, he looks great because he has compartmentalized to the point where he does not feel it anymore. So they get into a fight, but then Julie informs them that she basically kept track of the news. And it turns out the guy they killed was named David Egan. And his body was found 3 weeks after they dumped him. He was caught in a shrimp net. And I was like, did Helen and Barry not read the paper? But like, okay, it was before the internet. Yeah. Maybe you didn't, you know, have a subscription. And so the police assumed, okay, it's an accidental drowning. I'm assuming all the other damage, like maybe he fell off a boat or something. Because he did drown. Like, he was alive and they dumped him in.
Right.
And so that's Barry's thing. Is like, we did kill this guy. Like, we could say the car accident was an accident, but we did kill him. And they're like, well, Barry, that was your idea, bitch. Like, yes, we did. But he's right.
We
like,
did
he,
that.
But he, it's like, you could have helped this person. He was alive. You could have dragged him out of the water and then gone to prison. You chose instead to dump this critically injured person in the water and then he drowned.
Into the ocean. Yeah.
And so they're all trying to figure out, okay, so if somebody would know, who would it be? And their first guess is, what if it was Max? What if he did see that we had hit somebody, or he figured it out later, having come across us?
Like, did Max send the letter?
Exactly. That's so is he doing it to fuck with us? And so
that
they
would make Max also very fucked up. Like,
let me tell you, everyone in this movie is some kind of fucked up. Like, everyone does not react to things in a way where it's like, just don't try to cover up a murder. Just don't do this to yourself.
Someone tell someone the truth.
Yeah. So it's off to the 4th of July parade preparations. And there's like a giant fish float. And Barry insists they go down to, like, I don't know what it's called, but it's essentially a big building where all the fishermen take their fish to put it on ice. Or to, like, immediately, like, flash freeze it or boil it or prepare it. A fish warehouse is what I've chosen to call it in my notes.
I think that that is an absolutely reasonable thing to call it. Fish warehouse, fish factory.
The fish factory.
I feel like would also.
So Barry's like, I'm going to go chat with Max. And because Barry's an absolute lunatic, he just goes in there and fucking slams Max against, like, a giant piece of ice and grabs a fish hook and is like, if you ever threaten us again, I will fucking kill you, and ends up cutting Max, like slashing him in the face. And it's like, if he is the person saying the note, then he's definitely going to kill you guys.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Enjoy the cold embrace of the grave, Barry. And then luckily, they run into Ray. So it turns out that he has his own fishing boat, and he... You know, he grew up around boats, and he didn't really know his dad, but he knew his dad was a fisherman. So I was like, being 19 and being a successful fisherman seems like a pretty successful, like, good for him, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that's something.
So Helen and Barry, like, go home, and Julie catches up with Ray, and Ray's very much like, you know, like, I wanted to talk to you. Like, I know you hold me responsible. And Julie says, I am responsible for my own actions, but I also don't want to know you. And she leaves. And so her thing is very much like, I do not want to be friends. This is not about that. We're just trying to figure out who's sending the note. This is not about us rekindling our friendships or our relationships. Unfortunately, poor Max, he's like angrily boiling some crabs for the 4th of July. And in the steam, it sort of obscures his vision. He doesn't see that a figure in a fisherman's coat, like a rain slicker and a hat, has grabbed the fish hook. And he just fucking swings it, stabs through Max's throat, and drags him away into the steam of the crab boil.
Why?
Does no one else work here? Allison, I don't know.
I don't know. I need a motive. I need something.
A killer's got to kill, and Max just happened to be the first on the list. That night, Barry goes to his gym. Again, he got to let all that aggression out. And when he goes back to his locker, he sees a Polaroid of his car, and he turns it over, and it says, I know. So Barry, he's literally just wearing a towel, like, tries to hunt this, like, figure that he keeps seeing walk through his gym. But by the time he gets back to his locker, it's open, his coat is gone, and his car keys are gone. So he runs outside, and his car is being stolen. So not only is this killer already murdered somebody that we've seen, he is a car thief on top of everything else.
Grand Theft Auto, murderer edition. That might be what Grand Theft Auto was.
Yeah. You are just the murderer running down Barry.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Barry tries to, like, essentially face off against a car, and the creepy figure driving the car not only slams his car into Barry, but essentially slams through the wall of the fish warehouse, throwing Barry's body through into a ton of debris, stands over him, and you assume he is about to gut this motherfucker. Luckily, in the morning, Julie arrives at the local hospital. Helen and Ray are already there. Barry is alive, but he's extremely pissed, and he still refuses to go to the cops.
Julie's only injury being hit by the car?
Yes, yeah. So he was not stabbed.
So it's not like he wasn't, like, stabbed.
And Barry's thing, like, this guy could have killed me, like, right then. He didn't. He's just fucking around. And Julie's like, well, his kind of fucking around is driving you through the side of a building, dude. Like, the jig is up. Like, he is going to do this to all of us, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to survive that. I'm petite, you know?
No. She's so small.
And so for the first time, you know, they're talking. Barry says, I didn't see his face. I just know he was wearing a rain slicker. And Ray's like, oh, good, because we live in a quaint little fishing town, so that should help us narrow it down. And Barry says to him, well, we all know you have a slicker, Ray. And that's the first time we have somebody suggest, Ray, where have you been? What are your motivations?
Yeah.
But Ray, of course, is like, fuck you. And he's sort of coming around to Julie's plan to tell the police. But Barry is still like, we are not doing it. If this guy wants to fuck with us, he's not going to the police. So we'll just confront him ourselves. And so...
Great idea.
Yeah. And Helen reasonably thinks, okay, it's got to be a friend or a family member of David Egan. So we just have to do some research about David Egan and find out who that could be to the local library that they can access online from home on a laptop. Yes. Perfect. I only care about accessing the local library.
Yes. Local libraries are the only primary source location that I would like people to be using in horror movies.
Right. I don't even want, it's like, if you could be on a laptop, I don't want you to say I'm on the internet. I want you to say I'm accessing the local library from my laptop.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes. I've got digital microfiche coming in through Ethernet. That's what I want the research element of this to be.
So they discover in library files that David Egan's fiance, Susie Willis, died actually 2 years ago. So he was driving. The car went off that same road near Dawson's Beach. He was able to get out, and his fiance, Susie Willis, died. And it sort of would explain why we saw, like, why we saw that figure on the bluff drinking and sort of looking bummed.
Yeah, why he was so depressed.
Yeah. And Julie's like, oh, I remember that tattoo of Susie's name on his arm. So they're like, okay, his only living relatives are his mother, Claire, and his sister, Melissa, Missy Egan. So they're like, we're going to go talk to them out in the middle of nowhere and try to figure out if they might be doing this. Meanwhile, we've already seen the killer, and we know it has to be like a man of considerable size, but... You know, we don't.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's going to be a small, older woman.
Well, I'll tell you who it's definitely not going to be, and that's Anne Heche, who plays Missy Egan. And let me tell you, if you're going to cast a spooky, only in 1997, if you're going to cast a spooky, rural, country butcher, are you going to cast Anne Heche with a pixie cut?
Yes.
You're just like, couldn't you get someone else in here, like a hulking woman who maybe it would seem like maybe she could have done it?
Yeah.
But she looks great.
Nope. Just a tiny little actress.
And they're able to bluff their way inside Missy's home by saying their car's broken down, they need to call AAA. And she's like, okay, two teenage girls, like, I believe it, you know. And while they're there, of course, Helen sees a rain slicker. That means nothing because we do know we live in a fish town. But,
yes,
you know, you hate to see it.
It is not great.
It turns out that the father has passed away and the mother is in some sort of home. So Missy is more than willing to spill her guts and, like, talk about her brother dying and you know, and everything. And so they kind of, like, very easily insinuate themselves in this woman's life. They have both lied about their names, so she wouldn't be able to easily find them, you know?
Right.
And so they're trying to talk about it, and they're like, you know, because they're like, oh, if David Egan's father's dead, maybe it couldn't be the father. He didn't have any brothers. So, like, did he have any, like, really close friends? And Missy says, actually, yes. Like, he had a friend that visited, at, like, to pay his respects after David died. His name was Billy Blue. And we started dating for a little bit, and then he kind of ghosted me. And Missy's obviously very lonely. And so Julie and Helen are like, bye, bitch. Like, we pumped you for all the information we could get. Good luck having a terrible, sad life where your whole family's dead or in a care facility. So they bounce. And they get home, and Julie drives Helen to her house. And Julie's, like, devastated. She's like, we destroyed that woman's life. Like, we did that. And Helen says, I don't think we're that powerful, Julie. You're giving us too much credit. You did kill someone. I don't think Julie's wrong about this.
You killed one of her loved ones. Like, okay, you kind of ruined part of her life.
Like, in any other situation, I would say, okay, you're right. I'm overstating things. If you murder someone, that is something that could ruin someone's life.
Yeah, I think that counts.
And Helen says, I miss you. I wish we could be friends again. And Julie just is like, I can't do it. Like, all of our friendships are now tied up in this. Like, I'm just going to drop you off. Unfortunately, Helen heads up to bed after drinking a full Diet Coke, which looks so good.
Wow.
And wow. You sort of see in her house, like, her dad's watching the baseball game, and he doesn't even acknowledge her when she comes in the door. And unfortunately, he's so engrossed, he doesn't even acknowledge that a man in a rain slicker and a giant hat and a hook also walk in immediately after her. And then hides in her closet.
The man in the slicker hides in her closet?
Yes, as Helen goes to sleep. And before she like, conks out, Elsa comes in. And she's like, I need you to open the store tomorrow. And Helen says, I have to ride in the parade. I was last year's Croaker Queen. You know, she's like Helen's furiously brushing her beautiful blonde hair. And Elsa's like, you're so pathetic. Like, you're such a has-been. Like, you're just living this fantasy world. Like, you're not so great now. Now you work at the store like I do. You're obsessed with your hair. It's ridiculous. In the morning, Helen wakes up to discover, worse than being killed, she's been given a terrible haircut.
Oh, no.
And there's a message on her mirror in lipstick that says, soon. And she punches the mirror and screams, which is a fabulous moment. So I'm like, are we to think that the killer waited in her closet all night just to give her a bad haircut and write soon? Did he have to poop or pee? Why didn't he just kill her or stab or do something? Kill her father, kill her Elsa or something, you know?
Right. It's so much work and so much sacrifice just to give somebody a haircut. And to, like, kind of taunt them.
I also think if someone were to give you a haircut at night, you would wake up. You would wake up.
You would definitely. And especially if you were sleeping on a full Diet Coke. That's not deep REM sleep. You are too caffeinated to, like, be fully out.
Oh, yeah. I'd be dancing on the ceiling.
Me too.
So, Helen is in a panic. She calls Julie. Julie leaps her car to speeds over. But she keeps hearing, like, a weird, like, rattling noise from the trunk. And she looks in the back, and there's a hat she does not recognize. Which, enough to send chills up your spine. No. Like a straw hat.
Even just a rogue hat will send me over the edge. And I haven't killed anybody.
Allison, she stops her car. She pops open her trunk. There's Max's dead body inside. And he's wearing Barry's jacket. But even worse, what is Max's dead body absolutely covered in, Allison?
Oh, no. Fish?
It's crabs. Crabs are drunk as all crabs.
Don't ruin crabs. Crabs are wonderful.
It's not the crab's fault.
Yeah, no, they're just...
Oh, pop open a hot, fresh crab. This is...
Hot, red
this
crab.
This episode's brought to you by Crabs Incorporated. The concept of crabs.
Of course, all crabs.
She slams the trunk. She runs over to get Helen and Barry at Helen's house. They run back. By the time they come back, that trunk is totally empty, other than normal trunk things.
I would also not have left the car.
Just drive the car. They're already dead. The crabs can't stop the car. Yeah.
Right. And who knows? Like, the last thing you need is, like, somebody, like, God forbid, like, somebody, like, accidentally, like, hits it while they're driving by and, like, the trunk opens or, like,
if
your mom...
Oh, that's a bad look for you. Absolutely. That's bad. You get rear-ended.
It's like, whose car is this? Well, there's a dead guy covered in crabs in it, so let's definitely find out whose it is.
And also, I think, like, even if we're to think the killer came back, got all the crabs, got his body in the middle of the day on, like, a suburban street, there would at least be the smell of crabs. Like, there would still be the evidence that dozens of crabs in a dead body. You'd be like, oh, well, it reeks. I believe you.
Yes.
But Barry's like, no, you made it up. It's like, bitch, you got attacked and knocked through a wall. Like, why are you thinking she's making this up?
Right. Why would she?
I don't know. So then there's this iconic moment. You probably saw it on the MTV Movie Awards where Julie turns and she screams to the sky like, well, if he's going to kill us, just kill us. And she goes, what are you waiting for, huh? What are you waiting for? It's a great question.
So that scene. Now, I heard this on another podcast, so I have no... I don't know if it's true, and I forgot to look it up before we did the episode.
That's the kind of stuff we promised you on our podcast. Absolutely.
That's the kind of didn't access my local library on my laptop research that comes to that this podcast brings you. That scene was directed by a kid who won a contest?
Yes. I have also heard this. I don't know if this is true. I'm looking on the website. And my website, I do mean Wikipedia. I'm not coming up with anything off the top, I'll be honest.
Wait, I've got an AV Club.
Great.
Here's a reminder that I Know What You Did Last Summer's best scene was apparently pitched by a kid.
Okay, great.
So some kid won a contest to be on set that day. And since it is, I guess the novel it's based on is a YA novel, which makes sense that woman would be angry. That became a slasher film and not just a mystery. and that the kid thought it would be interesting to have her character start screaming in the street. And though the cast and crew decided to just humor him at first, they realized that this was doing amazing. So there's not a ton of evidence, but that is something that she says. Jennifer Love Hewitt has confirmed.
Well, shout out to that kid, whatever their name is. Yes. Hope you're doing well. Hope you have you're being rewarded for your ideas in adulthood by people remembering your name, because we don't know who you are.
No, we don't know who you are. Even the AV Club article, shout out to the AV Club, just referred to him as, in quotes, that kid. So
I feel like the fact that there's so little detail makes me question this story a little bit, but
I do want to believe it.
Yeah.
I want to believe it, and therefore
and
I will.
I will, exactly. So Barry, Helen, and Julie meet up with Ray, and Barry immediately punches Ray in the face and was like, I know it was you. Great. What other weird fishermen are there? Well, the answer is at least two.
Many.
And so, Barry's like, I knew you were jealous of us. Like, I'm rich, and you're like this fisherman. You had to live this dirt life, and now you're taking revenge on us. And Julie calms him down and says, okay, Missy told us about this guy named Billy Blue. She graduated the same year as my sister Elsa. So we're looking through the yearbooks. They cannot find a Billy Blue, and they realize this person probably lied about his name, just like how we lied about our names with Missy. So Julie decides to go back alone to Missy's to have her identify Billy Blue in the yearbook. Well, Barry's going to go keep watch when Helen is in the parade. So Barry's going to be in the audience, and if Helen sees anything sketchy, he will be there to protect her.
Great, because he'll do a great job.
So we've seen so far, it means he's just going to punch people in the face. Ray, meanwhile, I think is the only one with a good idea. He's like, if this is all true, let's get the fuck out of town.
Yeah, I would just like up and look. Like, this is pre, you know, aside from the library, like pre-internet, like everybody constantly using it all the time to do everything. So like, I would just move. Like, it would be hard for someone to track you down if you moved to another city and changed your name.
Well, unfortunately, Julie's not having it. She's like, I got my life back. I want my life back, Ray, and I'm going to do it. Cut to the 4th of July, Independence Day Parade. There's fish floats. There's a clamshell. Helen's in a clamshell going down the street. It's like they shipped in thousands of people to just experience this parade and then sent them back to their towns in North Carolina. Yes. Meanwhile, Julie goes up to Missy's house, which is, again, in the middle of nowhere. It takes her hours to get there, seemingly, to have her identify this person. She gets to Missy's and, you know, she starts to sort of like spill her guts. And Missy's like, I know what you're going to say. I know my brother killed himself. But I couldn't tell the police that because I wouldn't have got his insurance. So if you're here to tell me, oh, you think he killed himself, believe me, I know. You know, it's just that I didn't want that to become public because the family needed the money. And Julie's like, well, I wasn't going to say that, but why do you think that he did kill himself? And she says, because he left a note. And she hands Julie the note. And the note says, I will never forget last summer. And Julie tells Missy, this isn't a suicide note. This is a death threat.
Wait, so she had a note that she got this, like, this same year that this all is going on.
Before Dave and Egan died, he received a note. But Missy, after his death, found the note and thought, okay. I will never forget last summer. He must be so much in grief about Susie's death. This note is a suicide note. Julie says, because she's clocking the handwriting.
Yes.
She's like, this is not a suicide note. This is a note. David didn't write this note. He received this note before his death. This is somebody threatening them that they will remember Susie Willis's death. So there is a completely other different killer at foot. That Julie realizes we didn't kill David Egan. This other person killed David Egan. And Missy, of course, is like, I don't know who the fuck you are. You got to get the fuck out of here. Like, I can't be. First of all, I'm not going to tell anyone this because I want that insurance money because, you know, it was an accident. But also, you can't come up in here and tell me my brother was murdered. And like, what do you want me to say to you about that?
Right, because you have a note. Like,
yes. And so Julie realizes, wait a minute. To the beauty pageant. And she drives back. And the unfortunate, it seems like they're driving, like much like a lot of horror movies, they're driving like 5 hours each way in the middle of like a crisis. So she is driving. There's no cell phones. She is driving back to town. It's going to take her forever. Meanwhile, Helen on her route keeps seeing people. Again, it's a fishing village. A guy in a fisherman's hat, a guy in a slicker. Right. And Barry like punches out an old man. Like if they're just mayhem, you know. They're not
Barry
really
is a loose cannon at best.
And finally, at some point, she sees standing on a roof a guy in a rain slicker holding a hook. And so she's like, Barry, I saw this motherfucker on the roof. Like, we got to talk to the police or whatever. And Barry, God bless him. He's a fool. He says, no, I will watch you during the beauty pageant. You're going to be on stage anyways. She has to like sit on the stage. You're going to be totally fine. And Allison, I guess my question is now, based on the information I provided you at this juncture, who will survive?
Who will survive?
Barry's a goner, probably in the next 5 minutes. I think Jennifer Love Hewitt will survive.
Great.
I think that Ray will die.
Okay.
I think that Sarah Michelle Gellar, you know, we're mixing character names and actress names because
they're the same to me.
Straight. I think Sarah Michelle Gellar will survive. I think Anne Heche might die.
Okay.
If she's still in play.
Yes. Yeah. Missy is still out chopping fish in her backyard like you do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's what you do 5 hours inland.
I think these are all excellent guesses. Act three of I Know What You Did Last Summer. So she's speeding back to town. Again, if we had cell phones, she'd be able to just call them and say, hey, here are my concerns. It's not David Egan. It's somebody else that we need to figure out who it is.
Nothing makes me happier at the evolution of cell phone technology than horror movies. Uh-huh. It really proves to me, like, look, these things are really bad in so many ways, but they also are good.
100%. So speeding back to town, Helen is in the pageant. And she's sitting on the stage, so yes, she is safe. Unfortunately, Barry is up in that the balcony that we saw them in a year ago. So it's kind of like a catwalk slash, like, it's like storage up there. So no one else is sitting up there except for him. And he's watching, and Helen has to suffer through, like, all of these absolutely terrible contestants singing, like, the song from Fame. Unfortunately, this girl does not get through the song because Helen glances up just in time to see the killer just fish hook Barry to death up in the balcony.
Oh, being gutted has to be one of the worst.
I mean, when you think about how to potentially die.
I think being gutted is a top five.
Top five. Fire.
Yeah. Fire.
Maybe being gutted. I don't know. Alive. Gutted. Because these are all alive, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Drowning is something I would put up there. I've heard that it's terrible, like that, or like science has, like, yeah, somebody told, but like science has proven that like the panic that you feel is like very painful.
Being torn apart by an animal, like a tiger, I feel like would be pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like that's in the same general stratosphere.
That's true. It's gutted. A subsidiary of being hooked to death.
Yeah. There's gutted and then there's animal gutted. Anyway, so he gets gutted while she's on stage.
She tries to run up to the balcony, but everyone, seeing her panic, stands up and, like, runs into the aisle, like, thinking, like, not knowing what's going on. And by the time a cop arrives and takes her up to the balcony, both Barry and the killer are gone. And there's no proof. We, of course, as audience, see there's blood dripping down the banister, but the cop's like, this is some kind of prank. This is ridiculous. Like, and I'm like, can't you at least look around a little bit? Like, turn on the house lights, for God's sake? And he's like, this is ridiculous, some kind of prank. And she has to, like, sadly give her crown back and is kind of, like, humiliated. Because now they're going to finish the rest of her pageant. They're just like, you got to go, you know? So the cop says, I will drive you back to your house. Meanwhile, Julie gets home, leaps on her computer, connects to her local library, starts looking at the microfiche. Great. And the cop is, like, kind of making fun of Helen. Because Helen's finally telling him, like, there's a killer after us. A killer killed my ex-boyfriend, you know, that I'm still in love with. And he's like, Cap says, oh, I've heard this story before, but the way I heard it, you know, it's an escaped mental patient and they find the hook on the door. You know, it's kind of making fun of this.
It's like, well, we were doing that a year ago and look what happened.
Exactly. Unfortunately, as they start to drive out of town to take Helen home, they stop because there's a car broken down and Helen does not immediately notice that the person who is driving this car is, of course, wearing a rain slicker and a fisherman's hat. So when the cop gets out to go help this stranded motorist, Helen has like 2 seconds before she's like, oh, shit, don't do it. The killer immediately just hooks the cop, murders the cop.
Is she in the back of the cop car?
She is now trapped in the back of a cop car.
Back of a cop car is a really great horror device. They really capitalized on the absolute brutality of our police to keep people trapped like that. But it is scary.
The cop is murdered. The killer is out and about. And Helen is trapped in the back of this car. Luckily, she is able to kick in heels hard enough to get out of the passenger side window. So essentially kicks, shatters the window. But then she is on the street running from a killer who, from we can tell, is, you know,
huge.
huge, gigantic, has already killed twice in this day. So Julie finally finds the document she needs by accessing her local library. Susie Willis was survived by her father, Benjamin Willis, a local fisherman. Okay? So she's okay. Like, oh my God, the killer that is after us, it's not David Egan. It is, in fact, Ben Willis. Helen, meanwhile, runs to her family's store. Elsa, being a huge bitch as usual, has already locked up and barely gets the door open for Helen to come inside. And Helen's like, I gotta call the cops. Like, go lock the door. Unfortunately, Elsa does not make it to the second door in time. The killer hooks Elsa and then drags her body away as Helen is now trapped inside a department store with this guy. She is able to finally make it to the second floor. She is barefoot. She still looks great. She is still in her pageant gown. She has to leap from the second story, Texas Chainsaw Murderer style, onto like a pile of broken boards to escape.
Oh, God.
She runs down the alley just as she sees the parade marching by. Based on the scene earlier, the parade has been going for 18 hours.
Yeah, I mean, this is a lot of coverage for a parade.
Exactly. I guess they've been going around in a circle. I don't know. And unfortunately, between the fireworks and the parade, which is creating a lot of cacophony, no one can hear her screaming as the killer stabs her to death in a pile of tires. Helen, you fought valiantly. It's not going to happen.
Helen. I really had high hopes for Helen.
So Julie, unable to find Helen because, like, the pageant's over, runs to go find Ray on the docks. And she explains what's going on because you do need it at this point. And Julie tells Ray,
yes,
the person we hit wasn't David Egan. It was Ben Willis. I think Ben Willis killed David Egan, which is why they found David Egan's body in the water 3 weeks later.
I see.
But when we hit Ben Willis, he didn't die, and now he is seeking revenge against us for dumping his body, which we did do. We did do that.
That's true. They did do that. They did do that.
So they didn't actually kill anyone, as it turns out. But
yes.
They did try
to.
So Ray's like, oh my God, that's crazy. Come on my boat. And Julie almost does until she sees the name of Ray's boat, and it's called the Billy Blue. And she realizes that Ray was the person who went to Missy and lied about his name and had an affair with her. And Ray starts chasing Julie and screaming, you don't understand, let me explain. And Ray just gets clotheslined by another fisherman. And Julie's now to this stranger. Julie's like, do you have a phone? And the fisherman's like, yeah, just go on. I'm going my boat. There's a phone inside. As soon as Julie gets inside this boat, she takes a look around. First of all, she sees a hat that she recognized from her car when Max's body was in the trunk. And he also has like a full serial killer board of photos of Julie and her friends, and a clipping of Susie Willis's death, and then that medallion that says, I love you, when it spins. It just basically says, yes, it's me, Ben Willis, and I am in fact the killer.
I did it.
And now the fisherman who clotheslined Ray gets on the boat, and he throws off the little mooring that's tied to the dock, and she is now trapped at sea with Ben Willis, the man who has been hunting them this entire time. Alone.
This guy's good.
And Ben Willis tells her it's 4th of July.
Kids like you should be out having fun, drinking, partying, running people over, getting away with murder, things like that.
And Julie's a little bit behind us because then she's like, she finally understands who he is. And then for the rest of the film, it's pretty much just her running through the various rooms in a boat trying to escape death.
Oh, my God.
Like, he's got a hook. She gets into the ice room where, you know, they keep the fish fresh. Turns out that's where he's hiding all the bodies. In case you're like, well, where did he put Elsa or Barry? Threw them in the ice. They're hidden underneath where they keep the fish. But she's, like, scrambling around. There's all these, like, ropes and pulleys. And I don't know much about boats, but you can get killed just walking through a boat is what this
movie
makes.
Boats are already dangerous if there is no murderer aboard.
Luckily, Ray comes to on the dock, and he jumps in a motorboat, and Ray's able to catch up with the boat and get on the boat. And essentially
good
is
for Ray.
Fist fighting Ben Willis, who has, like, grown adult fisherman strength.
Right.
And at one point, knocks Ray completely off the boat, where Ray gets tangled in a rope and has to drag himself back on board. Finally, they are all on this boat. They are all fist fighting Ben Willis. And he turns to Julie and he has Julie in his grasp. He tells her, happy 4th of July. Next time you leave a man for dead, just make sure he's really dead. And unfortunately, this is the hubris of a killer. He swings his hook up to kill her, and he gets his arm tangled in the one of thousands of ropes on this boat.
Of course. It's your boat, man. You should know where they are.
Exactly. And Ray throws a lever, and Ben Willis is hoisted screaming into the air. His hand holding the hook is completely chopped off, and his body is sort of flung around wildly like a marionette until the rope flies off the pulley, and he is sent screaming into the ocean.
Wow.
Eventually, luckily, Ray could drive a boat, so they end up back at the dock, and Ray and Julie realize, like, we never actually killed anyone. And Ray's like, I did go talk to Missy, and I did lie about her name, and I did end up dating her, and I didn't tell you because I wanted to go out with you again, which is very sketchy, but, like, okay, I guess you didn't
work
colluding with a murderer, I suppose.
Right. Yes.
And the sheriff comes over, and he says, do you have any idea why this guy would want you dead? And simultaneously, Ray and Julie say, no. And that's pretty much it. They find Ben Wells' severed hand with a hook in a fishing net, and the sheriff says, don't worry, the body will turn up. They usually do. And a year later, we see Julie back at college. She's on the dean's list. She's glowy. She's happy. And she's making plans to visit Ray in New York. Unfortunately, her roommate drops off a letter with no postage. And Julie trepidatiously opens it. And it says, Kappa Beta wants to invite you to a pool party this weekend. It's fine. Aww. Unfortunately, she then goes to take a shower in the girls' showers. And it's written on the steam on the glass. It says, I still know. And she turns, and from inside the shower leaps a fisherman, which is a weird choice to end the film on. And apparently in the original film, she was chatting with Ray online, and then somebody messaged her online and says, I still know. And then a fisherman jumps out. It's just a weird choice to have somebody. I get it's the end. You want to leave it on a cliffhanger.
I get
it's
that.
Like, so a fisherman was in the girls' locker room at her college, and nobody noticed.
Yeah. Like, you would see somebody walk in and be like, well, what are you doing here in all of your black rain gear, you middle-aged man?
In the end, that is the end of I Still Know. Oh, I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Wow. Well, we'll have to do I Still Know because I know that that got made.
Because they absolutely go to a, I believe they go to a tropical resort. And it's clearly just shot, like, on a set in L.A. Like, it's just like, I don't know, we'll just shoot in someone's backyard. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Get a pool, put the kids in bikinis. It's a movie.
So I wanted to do a little segment called What Did You Do That Summer? And I just wanted to share any sort of embarrassing summer-related stories you might have. I have one that I will share and will give you time to think of any. And I remember going to Girl Scout camp, and it was a lot of fun. And we would do archery, and it was like hanging out with all my friends. But the toilet situation was such that if you had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you had to walk through the dead, dark woods, completely alone, no lights whatsoever, to a porta potty. And so as a result, I was constantly like almost peeing my pants that entire, like it was like a weekend or something. Because I was like, please, I can't, like something is going to eat me. I cannot do this. And I remember finally going with my friend and letting her go first. And she goes to the porta potty. She comes back out. She's like, I can't find the toilet. And I laughed so hard that I peed my pants. But then everybody found out about it because I had to go back and like have pee pants. And it still is one of the funniest things someone's ever said to me, where someone's like, I just can't find it. And I don't know what she meant. I guess she just assumed it was too dark is what she meant. But the shame of having to go back into that cabin full of like a dozen girls and be like, well, in case you smell pee, it was me. I peed my pants. And that was sort of my whole weekend after that. And that just really brings me back. Allison, do you have any
I remember memories? I was a teenager at this point, but my dad and I did like a sailing program because like Annapolis sailing. And it was just kind of like learning how to like the basics of sailing and like taking out little sailboats. And like there was like an instructor and like maybe like four or five other people and like me and my dad. And like I had a pair of sunglasses that somewhere along the way I had also lost, even though we were only in a classroom and then a boat. So like, I don't know where that happened. But I also got my period in a way
and
was not prepared. And like, as a kid, like you also like never know to like, just always have a tampon. And like, it was just like a bunch of men and like my dad, who I like also didn't want to be like, I got my period. And like, it was like definitely, like I was wearing like dark shorts, but there was like a little bit of light on them. And then like, that's where, and I was just like in the bathroom, like scrubbing them. And then my dad was like, are you just like super upset that you lost your sunglasses? Like super mad at me about like being like, I was like, I don't want to go. I want to go home. I don't want to do this anymore. And I was like, he was like, are you mad you lost your sunglasses? I was like, yes, that's it. That's what I'm mad about. Like he had no idea. And it was devastating.
Did you ever tell him?
No. I guess if he ever listens to this, he'll know. He won't.
Wow.
No, I was just like, my sunglasses.
That's devastating.
I don't know.
That's a wonderful memory.
14 or 15.
It's humiliating at any age. If it happened now, I'd be like, I need to go home. My sunglasses, it's that. I got to go.
Yes.
I would never own a pair of white pants or even light colored pants. Just, you know, no. It's just not worth it.
I did buy a pair of like off-white, like canvasy jeans this year. And I'm just like, I guess I could, there's like 1 week a month where I will feel comfortable in these.
Right. Yeah. You could do it immediately afterwards. Yeah. 1 week and then that's it.
You get
and
1 week.
The rest you just don't know.
It's the inverse of what your period actually is.
And really, shouldn't you be wearing white jeans more than that? I think
no.
Once every 4 weeks seems
that's
reasonable.
True. That's nature's way of keeping us all in check style-wise.
So, Allison, would you say there were any fatal mistakes that anyone made, if they come to mind? And I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Fatal mistakes.
I mean, I'll say it again, not immediately telling the authorities when you just hit someone and mm-hmm. trying to throw them in the sea to get away with it. But I would also say Barry not telling them that he saw the guy's eyes open is arguably as big as them not telling the cops when they hit him.
Yeah, I think Barry, it's like, okay, you're driven by the fact like you don't want to embarrass your rich family and you don't want your like wonderful life to be ruined. But you have to consider the alternative, which is that, you know, like your entire life could fall apart at any moment when somebody finds out about this. So it's like, you're not really outsmarting the system by lying. You are just prolonging the dread and horror you're going to live in. That being said, I mean, Barry made mistakes. Everything Barry did was a mistake. They could have gone to also the cops would have been like, you didn't kill this person.
Right.
Because we know they didn't, you know?
Right.
That was not what happened, but I think they all made the initial mistake. And that's the lesson of horror is once you make that initial mistake, there's no going
back.
There's
no coming back.
Yeah.
There's no coming back.
And to be fair, they kind of did get away with it, you know? Like no one will ever know that they hit somebody and they dumped him in the water.
Right. Though, I mean, two of them died.
Yes, but two of them lived. To be one of those two. That's goal.
The brunettes win.
The brunettes win. That is also the moral of a lot of horror movies. If you're a brunette and you're not a
huge slut. The brunettes.
Yes. Yeah, we will take it. And finally, Allison, where would you put I Know You Did Last Summer on the spooky scale?
A spooky scale.
I mean, this movie is so fun.
Yeah.
Do I think it's super spooky? I think I'd give it a 5.
Okay. Great.
What about you? Where would you rank it on our super scientific scale?
I love this movie. I would say a 3. I don't find it scary. It's just fun. It's just pure popcorn, see it in the theater with a bunch of your friends, scream, laugh. Is it going to set a chill up your spine? Absolutely not, you know? But that's also what's fun about this era of horror movies is that it's more of like a murder mystery or it's, you know, there's sort of a whodunit element to it rather than you're actually going to be scared. It's sort of like, like PG-13 slasher movies. Yeah.
I feel like this is in the world where we often discuss like horror versus thriller. Like this is almost more of a thriller, even though it is like a horror movie.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much for listening. We hope you had a wonderful 4th of July. I hope everyone at your barbecue enjoyed hearing this.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys are like stuffed with burgers and hot dogs and grilled
that
veggie
so
skewers.
Good.
I know. It's like all I want now is like grilled food. And, you know, you all got to enjoy this and now you'll get to watch some fireworks. And we're glad we got to spend this holiday with you.
And again, we are bringing this to you from the past because we are recording this slightly before the holiday. But we will see you on Tuesday, as we always do. So until then, we love you very much.
We love you.
You're very good listeners. As always, you could email us at ruined@theradiopoint.com. And
you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Ruined Podcast. And send us recommendations, questions, concerns, fun facts, anything you want. We're here for you.
And until next time, please.
You must.
Keep it spooky.
Keep it spooky.
Ruined is a Radio Point production with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, and Houston Snyder, recorded and edited by Kat Iosa.